When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 154. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I am not going far at all, just over the English border into North Shropshire, in fact, to speak to farmer Tim Ashton. Tim, how are you?
Hi, well, thank you.
Good. Finally, we're doing this, Tim. We've had to rearrange a record number of times, I think, for the podcast.
Yeah, we're going to blame the weather mostly for that, though, Will, aren't we? Not my technical incompetence on
that. No, it's definitely the weather. And also, we were at your place a few weeks ago, but you were far too busy dealing with lots of people to speak to me that day.
Yes, yeah, well, it was a busy day, and it was ambitious to think that in the middle of having, I think, about 100 people gathered here for a play, I might have time to sit down with you for 40 minutes. With another play in about an hour after you had left as well, coming.
Definitely. Well, we had a brilliant day anyway, but we'll talk about that later. Now, Tim, regular listeners to Rock and Roll Farming will know that I am the biggest of history nerds, and you live in the right place for that. There is extraordinary history on your farm. Perhaps you could give us a brief run through it.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of history on many farms. It's just kind of survived well here, and it's kind of one package, I guess. But I guess if I start the earliest bit that we know of and then go forward.
Yeah.
So I know some farmers will find bits of like worked flint axes and things from the Bronze Age and before on their farms. And we have found a little bit of that once, which is kind of rare to find in Shropshire because... we don't have any flint naturally in our geology, but that's about 5,500 years old. And that goes back to the dawn of farming. And then, in prehistory, people don't leave so many records. But once you get to the Roman period, there is the Roman road from Wroxeter to Chester, or Uriconium to Dever, is on the eastern side of the farm here. And then we've had a practice of having archaeological digs here for the last few years with Dig Ventures, which is a participation thing that the public can subscribe to and then join. And last year they were digging up a mound, which I'll say more about in a second, but some of the stuff they were bringing out of there appeared to show Roman metalworking, which is about 2,000 years old. On the side of the roads, the farm is... has a brook running through the middle of it, and that's bridged, but one time would have been forded, and is actually one of the, if that bridge is out, you've got to go like 6 miles round, so it's a somewhat strategic place to yeah. put a house, which then explains the so one of the things that they were digging up from Dig Ventures was a best guess at the moment, because we've got to do more excavations. It's certainly early medieval, and the thought is it went up in the anarchy in 1135, where people just started freaking out and building castles of their own because it was a breakdown of central authority.
Yeah.
And
especially on the Welsh marches.
Well, yeah, totally, because Wem, which is the town which you probably have to drive through to get here, the history seems to record that the Welsh were burning that down about every 60 years until the end of the Wars of the Roses. and it had to have like either a wall or certainly an earth embankment around the outside and gates and everything because of visitors from Wales. And I imagine if you were farming, because even now it's about 8 kilometres walk if you go straight from here to the Welsh border. We're right on it. It feels a bit further if you drive because the roads don't go in a straight line. The railway messes it about, but. Yeah. Like in the time it takes to cook a chicken, you can be in Wales. So it's quite easy to see how, skirmishes on the border would have been quite common and disruptive to the guys living here back in those days.
Yeah.
And yeah, history does relate that the town of Wem was frequently suffering with that. So just beyond Shrewsbury and in the, on the proper borderlands. And then where have we got to? We got to the medieval period. Then there's a manor house built here in the 1550s by one of the first Protestant Lord Mayors of London, which you'd have seen as where mm-hmm. where we were talking.
Very distinctive looking house as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of a 40-foot cube. Some people say it looks like Battersea Power Station. There's lots of chimneys, and it's very square. I don't know whether that's unkind or not. I think that makes you smile. And then to round off the history, we've been in the last 5 years actually building a new long barrow with sacred stones, which is sort of developed into some of the sort of traditional ritual uses of land that would go back before the Romans. And it's, I suppose, the reason we're talking is the plays, I guess, isn't it, Will?
It is. And we will expand more on that.
So this is a long barrow that was on Country File a couple of years ago. Well, you've seen it and we can talk about it because it's probably a bit better for you to explain it than me, I guess.
I
hope that brought you up to date.
Absolutely fantastic. Have you, because I'm particularly interested in Roman history. Has there been any sort of Roman artifacts found along the road?
Not yet. I need to be quite stern about, we don't go looking for stuff unless proper archaeologists are doing proper studies.
Yeah.
Done irresponsibly, you can be very destructive looking stuff. And when farming itself can be at times destructive of archaeology, that's well known, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
So the sites that are likely to be interested here are regulated by the state. So no one can go there without permission from Historic England.
Okay. And Sultan itself, because you live at Sultan Hall, I read that in Saxon that means settlement with the plough. Is that right?
It can mean one of the, I prefer that. it can also mean settlement with reeds, which sounds less ambitious for a farmer. So I prefer settlement with the plough, but I think many people would say it probably means settlement with reeds, and I can definitely find you reeds here.
Yes. So what about your family connection with the place? How long have the family been there?
In a complicated way, since the guy who built this house in the 1550s. There's sort of going to cousins and stuff over that time. But yeah,
that's incredible. That really is incredible. I mean, people, that's older than a lot of countries, isn't it? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, a lot of countries aren't that old.
Okay. Growing up on the farm, did you, having that family connection, I guess, to the place and everything, did you want to be a farmer or did you want to just spread your wings and get away?
I think I always did, but my family were quite stern about training in other areas and going away.
Mm-hmm.
I think they didn't want people to feel obliged to come back and farm because it's a life with particular sort of skills and challenges and demands, isn't it? And I think they wanted that to be something that was opted into rather than a sense of obligation, which is, I guess, quite enlightened. I don't know, but that's certainly, they were quite stern that I couldn't train in agriculture initially, at least.
So what made you choose law instead? Did it always appeal to you?
It's quite kind of a complicated question that, but I think there's some interesting skills in there that are transferable. There's a number of people who are connected with farming who work in law anyway, when you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I was concerned that we should be treated fairly, I guess, as farmers, and then understanding some laws would be helpful in that. And I don't know, law is different things to different people, but it was, Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure in other people's business lives, the odd thing happens to you, and you're like, well, was that failed? Was that right? Should that have happened? And what, if anything, can I do about that? And if you think you think that things could have gone a different way, if you'd known a bit more about it or known the right people to talk to, then that was kind of, I think, at least subconsciously, why I thought studying law would be helpful.
Yeah. And you studied at Oxford University. What was that experience like?
It was a great privilege. I'm very grateful for that chance. And some things you see closer than others, like the Oxford Union, and that kind of raises your eyebrows when you get a bit more adult. Yep. But it's an incredible institution, and I think once you've left, you begin to realise how much of a gilded thing it was, because you could have gone to lectures on anything. Mm-hmm. Turns out you perhaps didn't, but like the chance was there. And I suppose it's still possible to access the libraries and those things after you've gone, and also possibly relevant later on. I'm still working with some people, I mean, some of the physics department in there on some of the work we're doing now. And we did what I did in the early days of changing to no-till, which I know you want to talk about in a bit. I did some work with the plant sciences department there as well.
Oh, that's cool. Fantastic.
Which is easier, obviously, if you've been to the university and then send them an email saying, oh, look, I study the wrong thing and I noticed you're doing it. and perhaps there's some work going on at Harper Adams, and if you sort of joined in with it, it would make it like a lot quicker for it to roll out to farmers, and we can make a change quicker than what we're doing. But one thing I had noticed in doing that is that when you get to elite universities doing pure blue skies research like that, then they are the plant people and they study roots specifically, and there's no one studying soil, and
okay,
that seems slightly dysfunctional sometimes,
right? Okay, so
study roots without soil. And I think that's changed a little bit because of some work we were doing at Harper and at Oxford about 3-4 years ago now.
Fantastic. So where did your law degree initially take you?
Well, the college I was at had, one of the people had been there before, had set up a law firm, which has some reputation in Los Angeles, and I ended up joining them for a while before I came home, just for a year as an intern, because these are restrictions and stuff, and you can't stay forever. And it was an educational opportunity, and it was a lot of fun.
I'll bet. I mean, what was that experience like? LA is a long way from Wem. It's
a long way, yeah. The more I talk about it, the weirder it's going to sound. I was very privileged to be put up because the firm owned a house in Malibu for the interns to live in.
Okay.
And so I was put up in Malibu and working in downtown LA, and it was a great privilege, and get a bit name droppy, but it was surreal, because one of the first things I did on the morning when I was settling into the accommodation the firm had given me, someone knocked on the door and asked me if I was a resident, and I said yes, and they said, will you sign this petition against Bob Dylan's Portaloo? And I said, of course I'm going to do that. Now, I mean, it's not common on Bob Dylan, but rightly to tell a story that you were living next door to Bob Dylan and had to sign a petition against his Portaloo was just too irresistible.
So, that's incredible.
I was living in the northern part of Point Dune, which is where quite a lot of the celebrities who live in that area are actually living. They're not in LA. And Julia Roberts wished me a happy Thanksgiving one morning, which was a highlight.
But it was.
But it was only 1 year, and I was determined to try and write down all of this ridiculous stuff that was happening.
Yeah.
And the warning is you should keep a proper diary, I think, because I'm sure I've forgotten some stuff.
That's so cool. And did you do did you have a convertible car and drive down one of those famous highways?
No, I had a Honda Accord.
Okay, not quite as glamorous.
Not really. And it's the person who'd owned it before me had been living in San Diego, so the colour, the paint suffered in front of it. It wasn't, I mean, I loved that car, but other people wouldn't instinctively love it. Yeah, and it was an interesting experience buying that, because I was a student and on a budget, and I was taken to Compton or Inglewood, and the guy who was selling it to me like had shot out windows of his parking dealership and or his car dealership and things. Yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah, again, a long way from sleepy Shropshire. So at that point, were you set on a career in law? When did you start to have thoughts about?
No, I think I'd always wanted to come home to farm. Okay.
Right.
And I have dyslexia, which I don't mind talking about, but it does have, like, I think the big picture level, I find law quite easy. Is that a bad way of putting it? Like, I sort of get it, but mm-hmm. I think when clients see spelling mistakes in memos you've written and stuff, it begins to be probably a challenge, I think.
I suppose one of my daughters is quite dyslexic. I mean, I guess there's a lot of extremely successful and high profile people who are dyslexic, isn't there? So I guess it's talked about and accepted far more, I suppose, now, isn't it?
I think so. I don't want to sort of accuse dyslexia of being the reason why I didn't pursue it, but I am conscious of that. And my route through university, I certainly remember that being, I don't know, if you live with dyslexia long enough and are writing, I don't know how many people with my level of dyslexia are at Oxford reading law, but I do remember, I won't accuse the whole university of this, but I do remember one tutor being really kind of petty and vindictive about it. And it was kind of, I don't live with it long enough and it's just not very interesting.
Mm. Okay.
Because you've got to try and get the idea out and you can only do it your way.
Sure.
And if you want to spend a 1 hour tutorial with like 30 minutes talking about your spelling of check, then it's a waste of my money and his time.
Mm.
But anyway, I'm sure it wasn't enough of a barrier to stop me getting to Oxford, but I didn't want to be held accountable for there's other things I can do.
Okay. So when did you start to seriously plan on going back to the farm?
I think it's that LA thing. I remember my folks came out to see me in LA and we had a bit of a conversation there about it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't really make any plans other than coming home. So that would be at the end of that year.
Okay. So when you decided to go back to the farm, did the system at the farm look like then? What was happening at the farm at that time?
Well, to understand our farm, you've got to understand that it's kind of a sort of land-based business that also faces sort of tourism and other things.
Mm-hmm.
But specific to the farm, it was a min-till regime of arable farming. So I don't know whether that needs explaining for your listeners more than that, does it?
Yes, perhaps you could just expand on it a little bit.
So we hadn't been ploughing. So we raise crops. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And we hadn't been ploughing during probably for about 10 or 15 years. But we'd been doing fairly deep stubble cultivating. So sort of whisking the soil, I guess, if you mm-hmm. want to explain that. That was the approach to growing crops with a rotation that was, at the time we had a big block of stewardship in there, which I quite a badly designed scheme. High mid-tier stewardship had this option called summer fallow, which obligated the farmer not to grow any crops, but mm-hmm. then just to cultivate the fields, I think at least three times.
Wow.
And I remember walking farm in the last year of this with a guy called Professor David McDonald from the zoology department at Oxford, and asking him what he thought the environmental benefit of doing this was, and he said, well, I can't really see it, and this might as well be the moon.
Mm.
And why are we subsidizing this activity? But you know, that was how they designed high-tiered stewardship at that time.
Yeah.
And then the rotation beyond that was wheat and rape.
Okay, so where did your interest in the soil specifically come from? Is that something you were always interested in? Or
well, I had a couple of years farming, and there's a sort of quite a well-worn path of being a farmer's son and just going home and doing what dad did, I think, isn't there? And that's no disrespect to my father, because he studied in his time hard as well, but I remember our accountant and my dad saying, look, you're not really good enough to sort of just fall into this. You've got to study properly and know what you're doing and have a strategy. So I went to Harper Adams to do a master's, which initially started off as being sort of farm business management and then quietly fell into being negotiated study. And I'm sure it was a pain to the people at Harper for trying to design my course a lot and finding some of the things I wanted weren't there, which isn't any disrespect to them. So we just built a program about what I wanted to do. But when you start looking at farm business accounts a lot, there is a difference between farm performance on crops, and it does appear, the more you look at it, that the aspect of tillage and ploughing can add substantially to the cost of producing a crop and therefore affects the margin that you're able to get the other end of it. And the other part, the other thing that you kind of want to think about, completely relevant to this conversation now, the weather is getting more extreme. Like land we have had, yes, which hasn't flooded in my dad's entire memory, has not flooded three times in the last 10 years. And, you know, when it first happened, it was supposed to be a once in a century event. And now it hasn't happened this year so far, touch wood. But I think most farmers, and you probably agree with me, are saying that things are getting more extreme. And the other point beyond the sort of financials is just the pure resilience and workability of a farm. If you haven't looked after the soil and thought about it, I know I'm not the owner, I'm not as vocal as some about this, but if the soils have been mistreated and they can't handle water properly, you know, when you till soils, they become something like 10 times less good at managing water. The operations you have to fit in are more. And on top of that, if the conditions are extreme, the days when you're going to be allowed to do them become shorter. So we're about 6 years into no-till here now. And I was sowing wheat during the storm. We fortunately were just on the edge of it. It was raining a little bit. It would have been impossible to consider that with the old system. And we did 40 acres in a day of clay, which I think we had 44 millimeters of rain. I think that if we had much more rain this week, you'd be looking at a situation where you probably couldn't go back to that till the spring, and it might be quite late in the spring. And then if we have droughts like we've experienced this year, that's, you know, late sown stuff that went in badly and then suffers a drought is not ideal, is it?
So. No, not at all. So when you decided to go down that route, how did you initially go about it? Did you look at loads of different drills and go and look at lots of different farms, or was it more important to get people, experts, I guess, to look at your farm and your fields?
I think we did the second one. I think I would approach the change slightly differently another time, I think.
Okay.
It felt somewhat urgent, I think, as a requirement to change, because it's not just the volatility of the weather. I'm sure that we're not farming very far away from each other, and I think, you know, we probably get slightly more extreme weather than you would find further east.
It's
not an unreasonable thing to say. On top of that, it's the issues you get with, you know, weed burden, and the farmers getting a lot of brome on it, because I think actually this min-till regime where you try and work up the soil and then chip to the weed, I think it's really dumb, to be honest, because there's no way you're going to get rid of the grass weeds in with that system, and you're also going to make the soil incredibly vulnerable to the weather. And we were getting a lot of pressure from brome, which is a grass weed, and we were not in a black grass area at that time, and you kind of watch it sort of incubated around the A1 and swilling across this side of the country, and you kind of want to plan for before it arrives. I think that was one of the reasons why we moved as fast as we did, because we just didn't want to see even worse grass weed problems than we have been able to manage those off the farm substantially, I think, in the last 6 years.
Okay, so what was the steepest learning curve with the transition? You said you wouldn't want to go through it again.
I think I think people can be kind of doctrinaire about it. Like, you get this kind of one massive principle, you must never, ever move any soil. And I think sometimes if you sort of light things on the surface, like this year, because of the very heavy rains, some of the soils, I've got a front press on the tractor ahead of it, because I think the slightly siltier clays will just... the slots may not close properly. The wind, when you've had a drought like we have, and then it suddenly comes wet, they're not ideal situations. And I think in the spring you can get this issue where the slot will open up again if you've used a disc drill, which is the drill we are using. And other growers will use tine drills, which we don't really have convenient access to. But in the spring I did an experiment with this wavy disc front press that we have, and it stopped there being this one line that would open up and when you get stressed. So it seems to work for us, and I will be doing more of that. But at the beginning, lots of people tell you must never move soil, and I think some people who are further down the line, like Simon Cowell in Essex, who I went to see recently, he's quite happy to run a chain harrow over the top if he thinks the soil needs it after he's drilled. You're not doing anything to fiddle with the soil column, you're just literally tickling the top to put that in the right heart to get it through, because it's vital that the crop is established properly, because it's what's looking after the soil. Yeah. And if you get past your grim establishment, then the soil will actually start to go backwards. Like, a healthy crop is the best way of having the soil looked after. So if you have to compromise your principles a little bit, I think be prepared to do that, certainly whilst you're converting. And then you'll know later on whether you should be thinking about doing that or not. But I don't know what you're like. We're on basically every conceivable soil type in a fairly small area here. We've got clay, loam, sand, peat, black sand, which makes it a good farm to learn on.
Very much so, yeah.
But and in some, most years, there should be at least one part of it that the conditions are favoured, though I'm not sure where that was.
Okay. And I guess that system sort of fits well with your general ethos. You are quite focused on being a sustainable business, aren't you?
I've done a bit of advocacy, I guess, around that. But I think... that came from, so my MP is Owen Paterson. He's somewhat active in agriculture policy, and before the Brexit vote, his views are well known. Mm-hmm. But we'd been talking, and he was explaining where he thought his head was going in terms of public money for public good. And I simply wanted to make it land in his head and the other policymakers' heads. And I mean, Michael Gove was here, that if you're going to conceptualize what public good might be, and then you're going down the line of thinking it's about biodiversity, carbon sequestration, soil water management, climate change, and those sorts of things, then it's quite important that they understand that how we manage soil is a really important aspect of that conversation. And he had initially been sort of pointing at the wood on the farm and saying, well, we can, that's interesting, we'll maybe look at that being a place where public good happens, and then pointing at literally everything that wasn't a field or crop production. And I was trying to make the point, which, you know, is now in the Act, I'm sure not just my work made that happen, that soil health is... it's not unreasonable to regard that as a public good. And then there is a challenge there where people say, well, it's a private benefit that the soil is in good heart and it should be what farmers are doing. But actually, most of what people who are environmentally minded, climate change minded, want to achieve can't really be done unless the soils are in good heart. And there is debates in agriculture can be quite strange. I'm sure, like, people like looking in from outside, like, the science is not complicated. Like, we can, according to some papers, I'm not sure I get behind them, there's one by a guy called Lau, you could completely mop up all carbon that was being put into the environment from industrial and human activity. Each year we could get to net neutral by simply abolishing tillage globally. It's I'm not saying I support that paper, but let's say he's half right, it's still a very substantial contribution to the challenges that we face. And I think it feels less controversial than it might have done even 5 years ago to say that we've got a problem with climate change and we need to wise up and start. Well, I mean, there's various documentaries just come out in the last days, and they're talking about mass extinction and stuff. But ultimately, I would like to think it should end up being good business anyway, because it basically costs a farmer money to lose carbon, and ideally he should be paid for it when it goes off the farm, which certainly is a way that some people are starting to think, including sort of Monbiot and others.
Previous podcast guest, George Monbiot.
He's visited this farm a couple of times. So, and I think he's obviously an activist and needs to say extreme polemical things to get people's attention. But I think people could engage with him more constructively with probably more things we can agree on than the sort of polarized way things get reported.
Definitely, yeah. Well, I actually largely had a very positive response to that interview from farmers as well. A lot of farmers were very sort of surprised about exactly that, how much more we had in common.
And I think it's actually very important for farmers to recognize that we should spend more time on the same side of the table with environmentalist campaigners than we do, like, opposing them, because our interests are not actually that far aligned. That's relevant when we get onto the conversations about environmental standards and welfare, and these are live issues at the moment when we're recording this, aren't they?
Tell me more about the diversifications on your farm. I mean, you've got a wedding venue for a start, and accommodation. That's exciting.
Yes, it is. And a lot of fun, some stress as well sometimes, but it is really fun to be involved in. It's a very sort of sacred thing that people are asking you to be involved in, really. They're very important days. We're talking specifically about weddings, and it's really wonderful to have people celebrating those things. So obviously feeling a bit nostalgic for that now, because the last time any serious celebrations happened was more than 15 people, which mostly people are not doing, because that's 13 guests, isn't it? Which is an unfortunate number anyway. It's also an odd number. So I think that's obviously, we've got people we're supposed to be looking after this year, and we need to keep some dates back to look after them, because they need to be treated fairly. And the accommodation, obviously everything shut down for a while, and now we're back on with some things, and then we thought a bit creatively about how we have the infrastructure that we do have here that can greet people, and some of the challenges that are facing other industries, particularly people who want to do live performances. The theatres are all shut, and that's likely to carry on really well into next year, isn't it? And that is why you came, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, the conversation.
I mean, just before we start talking about the theatre, when you have wedding guests, when life is normal and you've got weddings there, do you encourage them to get out and about around the farm and the property while they're staying there,
Weddings, their minds are on other things, really. But I think some of the values of the farm are interesting to them, and I think that's some of what they're subscribing to. But certainly when people are, like, for now, actually the hall is still receiving guests. We turned off the online booking, we buffered the rooms and stuff, because we just don't want to be operating at commercial full whack in a pandemic where you've got to make sure that you're being responsible and safe. So some folks left yesterday morning, and they basically just wanted to switch off from the world for 3 days. And obviously if you're trying to be a tourist at the moment, there are challenges about whether things are open and things, so they were just, I think they just walked around the farm really for 3 days. We do encourage people to do that, and you can't preach at people, but you try and gently get them to think in a different way. And I think a lot of people are quite, if they're coming here anyway, they're already aware of the sort of values that we're representing, and if they aren't, that's kind of their fault. So we're pretty clear about what we believe in, I think, trying to do for people.
So tell me about the Open Air Theatre. How did that first come about? Where did you get the idea from?
Well, I think I've had to explain this a few times. I think there's an article in the Times today about it as well, and I haven't had a chance to read it. But it is a slightly odd thing to explain, because from absolutely nothing to putting on plays on the farm is quite a big leap, I think.
Yes. but
so it might be worth talking with your audience a tiny bit about the Barrow quickly, because that's kind of what triggered the change of relationship with just a bit of the farm and the local public. And then if we've got that in their heads, and I think they'll understand why it was fairly gentle and kind of coming not entirely from my own head, but the pressures of the people we're looking after around us.
Sure. Tell me about the long barrow on your farm. And tell, well, first of all, I guess explain what a long barrow is for people who might not know.
Sure. Well, to explain this, we've got to go back to the late Stone Age. This is about 5,500 years ago, and the Stone Age arrives slightly late in Britain. Europe has been doing the Stone Age for a while, and we're still Mesolithic here, hunting and gathering. And then the Stone Age turns up here with a bit of fanfare, and that means they bring agriculture, they bring sort of pottery making and ceramics, and they bring architecture in its first form.
I'm just imagining sort of Iron Age Brexiters furious about the Europeans coming over here changing our ways.
Well, keep away from the politics of it. It's a historical fact that we were bidding defiance to, like, well, maybe we didn't think it was progress. And in some ways, things did go backwards a little bit when agriculture came in for mm-hmm. human health, actually. Mm-hmm. For a while, anyway, people were shorter, and then nutrition was well, that's a whole big academic space. Anyway, barrows are the first bits of stone architecture that anyone did. So okay. It's a brand new idea, and they are lots of things. Probably they are certainly associated with honouring the dead and keeping their remains in a sacred space. Mm-hmm. They were monumental. If you go to the Stonehenge landscape in Avebury in Wiltshire, obviously Stonehenge itself is very famous, but it's part of so hundreds of acres of ritual landscape that they built for. I don't know, not everybody likes this metaphor, but I think farmers get this period of time where things are a bit quiet in a kind year, sort of before harvest, and then again mm-hmm. after harvest. And I like to think, and I'm not alone in thinking this, Neil Oliver has done a podcast recently talking about this, and it's a really good set as a podcast, if I can sort of cross-promote it in your thing here. And he does one on Avebury, where he says that, in that slack time, humans are a social animal, and the farmers of the Neolithic started building these monuments as a social activity, really. And then it kind of got a bit out of hand, and it's a jump cut 3,000 years on. And somebody just started putting one rock on top of another, and then you've got like 100 acres of ritual landscape with avenues of standing stones and henge monuments and Stonehenge and the curses. And they were, he thinks, just people getting together and doing sort of overblown stag weekends or something. But anyway, barrows were certainly concerned with honouring the dead and being like a civic ritual space. And then quite quickly, within a couple of hundred years, they start building henge monuments and causewayed enclosures. And these areas, I mean, when you visit them, which I've visited quite a lot of them, in the course of doing the research, is that they're arenas and they're places for performance, I think. And if you think about human cultures that have settled and got agriculture, it's going to be quite, just think about school nativity plays, or people want to do poetry festivals, and Glastonbury is an example of this mm-hmm. sort of stuff, isn't it? It's kind of intrinsic to humans. So I've kind of skipped about a bit in there, but it's important because you want me to get to why we've invited the theatre onto the farm and what we've done. So 5 years ago we built the long barrow, which we will complete this year. It's lined up with the rising sun on the summer solstice and the setting sun on the winter solstice, and it is a sort of shared sacred space that's neutral on matters of faith and conscience, like so it's being used by Jews, Christians, pagans, people of no faith. I think we've had 9 different religions represented at one time or another. Wow. Through how the monument is being used, because no one thing dominates it, which is quite tolerant and gentle in the polarized world we're living in at the moment.
Sure. Give us a sense of what it looks. I've been there now, but what does it look like for listeners?
Well, maybe do you want to explain what it looks like, and then I can.
Oh, I'm probably not as eloquent as you, Tim.
Okay, so it looks. I'm a bit reluctant to say this. It looks a tiny. If, just to get people in the right space, it looks a bit like Fred Flintstone's house on the outside, or my niece who was 4 when it was started, said it was a Teletubby house. So that's on the outside, it's an earth bank with a stone door to get in. Yeah. I'm sorry, that's just the best way of getting your listeners to understand what the outside looks like.
That's a pretty good description. It looks like one of the houses in Hobbiton, doesn't it, in Lord of the Rings a little bit, kind of part of the earth.
Yeah, and the originals are all over North Wales, and they would have come into here, but into Shropshire and, you know, Lowland England, but they've generally been damaged and removed by agriculture over the last centuries. And actively, because they were quite powerful things, and established powers that be over the last 1,000 years got very upset about them as a different kind of focus for theology and stuff. And I think the Catholic Church did actually have the death penalty for people who built barrows for 1,000 years.
Really?
To stamp them out. Yeah.
Okay.
They did. Wow. I found this out after I built one.
So I won't tell the Pope, Tim. You're okay.
And then when you go inside, we've got one chamber finished at the moment. There'll be 2 chambers when it is completed, and the whole thing is going to be done by before this Christmas, before the winter solstice this year. You've got sort of pillars of stone with niches between the pillars rising to about 3 meters high. And then there's a stone corbelled roof. So you need to think... I'm trying to think, like St. Paul's is a famous dome roof. It's much, much smaller than that. And then it's made by just putting one stone on top of another and getting smaller and smaller as you go up with a technique called corbelling. And that rises to 6 meters above your head in the first chamber. And then the next chamber, which the lads are about to start on within the next fortnight, hopefully, is a significantly bigger chamber. So I think that one will raise to nearly 9 meters tall. As far as we can tell, it's going to be the biggest roof of that type since the Temple of Agamemnon in Crete in the Bronze Age. You know, once the Romans came along with concrete, if you were going to build this way, like the Pantheon in Rome, you didn't bother doing it the way we're doing it. But we've tried to approach it in a way that a Neolithic builder could have achieved this. And in some of the monuments that survive, the first chamber, it's not very far off Mace Howe, which is up in Orkney.
Fantastic. I mean, what struck us, I went there, my wife and the kids, and we all walked over there, as you know, and what struck us was there was quite a few people there, and there was a lady, an older lady, visiting a husband, whose remains were in the barrow. And it was a very kind of a happy place. So she was talking to us, she was talking to the children, she was very open and telling us, you know, she brings her dog, her and her dog go to visit her husband, and it was a very I don't know, it was just very relaxed and open, and it felt like a celebratory place, I guess.
We've been working quite hard to make sure that this is like a big difficult conversation in a way. I mean, our culture isn't very good at talking about mortality and death. If you go back 100 years even, or go back to the Elizabethans, they were obsessed by it, like their paintings of what, like rotten fruit and flies in it and all of that stuff, and that's what that's about. And then Shakespeare was obsessed with it, and then we've come up with a very squeamish attitude about it, I think. I know you've talked about succession planning and stuff before on here, and you know, that it is unhealthy that we can't talk about something that is actually an essential part of being alive.
And
I have to be very careful what I say here, because where people have made previous choices, you don't want to challenge those.
No.
You know, everybody is vulnerable. But I do have concerns about the approach we have to cremation in particular. It seems to me to be, it had to be campaigned for very hard in the sort of from the Victorian period onwards, and it wasn't really culturally accepted until post-war period. And it is a kind of very 1950s vision of the future, with sort of oftentimes quite ugly local authority run buildings, which are incredibly functional, and to me focus largely on waste disposal. I mean, that's a blunt way of putting it, but when we lose people, we want to gather to support each other, we want to honor and remember that person, we want to celebrate them. And finally, there's issues about public health, and but you essentially go to a crematorium and you've only got a 40-minute slot. There's a massive car park. There's queues of people, and no one goes back to a crematorium on any significant anniversaries, as far as I can tell. Really, that is not cultural practice. It is normal. And other cultures seem to be a lot. They were using. They were using cremation in the Beaker period, in the Bronze Age, in the late Neolithic, but they created monuments that really worked very well, because they related the human life to the past and also to the future, and the shared activity of building monuments, and they were beautiful things. And then there was, I'm sure, practice. Well, we know because the Romans were interring people in the edge of barrows that were already for them 3,000 years old. They're quite nurturing and beautiful things, and they're just a work. They're also out in nature and related to the rising sun on certain days. There's like an invitation to go back there, and it spontaneously forms a community, which is like the one you were describing.
Yes.
And I couldn't really have known all of this when we started, but I was. There's some magic in what the guys who did the first ones were up to. And
there was a quote I read, I think it must have been on your website. Celtic Christianity has a term, a thin space, meaning a place where the boundary between mundane preoccupations and the sublime is especially porous. I thought that really touched me. I thought that was really quite wonderful.
Well, I think there are most... I think you'd be quite an unfortunate human being if you never stopped and watched just like switch your phone off and stop talking and watch the sunset one day. Most people I've spoken to seem to have a memory of doing that. And it's quite poetic, isn't it? And that monument sort of forces people to do those things. It's very difficult to explain, and we couldn't have anticipated where we were going to land really from starting the project. But I know it's been, people, I've said before, people are squeamish about death, and we don't really know what to say to people who've suffered a bereavement recently. And I've never done this, but I've heard, people being conscious that people across the street to avoid talking to them because they don't know what to say. And that's really not what we should be doing. Because I think that there's something in this, because the monument is obviously addresses death, but it's also like in a living landscape where the harvest will happen. So if you're wanting to talk to somebody, they can talk to somebody else who's part of that community about the cropping that I've got, and how the linseed had to be re-drilled or something, or they can talk about cosmology or like big ideas, and they can kind of get lost in that, and they know they're sort of honoring the idea, but they aren't facing the really difficult stuff until they're ready. So we've explained that.
I do urge listeners to have a look at Salton Hall Long Barrow online. If you still can't picture how it looks like, do have a look. And it's Salton Hall, Soultonhall, have a look, because it really is a special place. And I, yeah, and it's also, I mean, you'll get embarrassed when I say this, but I mean, you've really added something to the community there. You've made a real special place. It's going to mean something to a huge amount of people, and what a legacy that is. Incredible.
Well, I think I am a bit sort of embarrassed by what you said there, but I don't think that I'm a rare farmer in thinking that our business activity and our stewardship of land is like a civic responsibility that isn't just to produce grain to sell or something. I think lots of farmers were quite concerned about the communities that, I mean, communities they were in when the lockdown happened. I know a lot of people were like positively encouraging people to walk on their farms, opened up some footpaths and were very accommodating. I mean, in the context of the key workers in the NHS doing what they do, don't think anybody in our industry should be asking for laurels, but I do think that many people involved in agriculture don't think that the responsibility begins and ends with raising animals and crops. We're an unusual industry because we're called agriculture, and you're not car manufacture culture, is it? We are. And I think farmers I respect often do kind of exhibit some concerns around those things on top of the day to day production of the stuff we're paid for.
Hopefully. Sure. So, Let's talk about the theatre, darling. Then building on from the barrow, you'd obviously got people coming on the farm and all we've talked about there, but how did it go from there to having open air performances on the farm?
Okay, so first thing I'm going to say is that this is really not my world in a lot of ways. So I think I said when you were here, my total acting career at school was a snowflake in the nativity when my twin sister came back as Angel Gabriel. My folks were like, so what have they decided to do with you? And I said, well, I'm a snowflake in the desert. And then I played the fourth wall of Jericho. Spoiler alert, I just had to fall over. And I was, bear in mind, the fourth wall of Jericho. So three people considered better at playing a brick wall than me.
That's incredible.
But I was sowing some spring beans up by the barrow, and I think we were thinking of how we could sort of develop that landscape a little bit to make it nicer for people to use, and it floods a little bit in front of that area. And I wanted to make it possible to walk on the line that the rising sun takes. So we're building a causeway anyway, which is... you can just imagine that we raised the ground by about 2 meters and then put some ditches that are quite big, sort of canals either side of that.
Yes.
Gives you kind of an invitation to wander through the landscape a bit. It was around the time that people started to beginning to be quite vocal about the pressure that live performance was coming under, and there were sort of rumbles about the Royal Albert Hall going bust and Shakespeare's Globe being bust. And it's a very, very concerning situation. And I have a few friends that are from university days who are in that space under a lot of pressure. And you know, some people got caught by some of the government support schemes, but a lot of people weren't because of the nature of employment in that sector. So you can kind of see from the conversations we've been having about the barrow that it's like a shared civic space. Yeah. And I thought, well, actually, we can take the opportunity of building this causeway that we're doing anyway to make an available space for live performance. Because, I think I explained before, I've been looking at a lot of the ancient treatments of landscape in Wiltshire and up, they're up in Yorkshire and down in Cornwall and out in the east. So I thought we could build a small version of one of those to make a statement, actually, that if culture cannot, live performance, and it's not just sort of the theatre darling stuff, it's comedy, it's live music. These are not things I consume a lot personally, but I really care that they aren't happening. And I think a lot of us can feel that way. If you're not like a religious consumer of this stuff, it's a bad comment on our culture if we aren't able to hold on to these things and keep them going, because they matter a lot. They hold a mirror up to us, and like question the way we're going, and you know, all sorts of things. So I talked to the masons at Sacred Stones who've been building this monument with us and said, look, let's fiddle with this design. And we, you know, we didn't have a great deal of money to throw it or anything. So we got the JCB 360 and scraped a line, and we're like, that's the stage. we spun the 360, JCB 360 round to draw a line, and then we raised the stage up for that, and then just put the buns on that, which are rate seating, which when things go back to normal, 200 people will be able to sit in there, and at the moment about 80 can. But and then BBC gave a Guru Kumar at BBC Midlands today, got hold of it and covered it, and then The Guardian covered it and The Times covered it today, and it's kind of become a bit of a movement. There's about four or five other farms looking at doing this, and the hashtag, which is On Farm Culture, because shows can still be put on. I mean, we're coming into the winter, so it's more of a question of programming the second half of the year, but sorry, 2021 now, but we've still got live music here next weekend, and then in the middle of October, the actual National Youth Theatre is coming to a field near Wem to do their first performance since the end of the lockdown, and that's a serious national company recognising that there's something quite special can be done, because you can approach things quite differently. Like they've written something specially, there's a tractor involved, they're borrowing a 4x4 off the farm, there'll be a fire. I mean, you could never do any of this in a proper theatre.
No.
Because, you know, it's out in a landscape, and we just have to take our chances. People might get a bit wet, but you have to treat it more like bonfire night than going to the theatre, I think, for that one anyway.
Yeah.
And you were, well, perhaps you can say a bit about it yourself. You were at Horrible Histories with your family, weren't you, about a fortnight ago?
We were, and it was just, it was brilliant, actually. I mean, there was a lot of people there, wasn't there? Was it sold out? It seemed like it was.
Yeah, you just said there was a lot of people there, so I need to be really so very clear about exactly how the risk was.
Yes, okay. You did a very good job of that. Everyone was spaced out. It was.
Yeah, well, I'm aware that I don't know how many people will listen to this, and I want to be very clear that it's not considered safe by people who know a lot more than me. To gather people indoors, but we know from the protest data earlier in the year that outdoor transmission is not a very realistic way of doing it, and you know, people were wearing face masks in appropriate places, and then the social distancing, that because of the scale of it, was done on the lawn where the weddings are often done, and there were 150 people present for that, but the social distancing was observed. The actors had formed a bubble in order to make sure that they were being responsible. And I think by the time you take the play you were at, we've had two bits of Shakespeare, we've had contemporary drama, Neville's Island, we've had rewriting of Alice in Wonderland called Alice in Lockdown, which was hilarious and really appropriate to the weirdness we're all going through now. And I think when you add up all of that box office together, that's 1,000 people who were able to go and watch a play, and they couldn't have done it. And the first play we put on was British Tory Shakespeare, who had been rehearsing Two Gentlemen of Verona, which is Shakespeare's first play, on Zoom during a lockdown. And then I think they performed it once before they got to us in London, and they came out to Shropshire to put it on, and that was sold out and was very good. But just at the beginning, you have to do a kind of air hostess kind of announcement, or you perhaps remember me doing that about keeping people safe, and then also trying to get people to be on board for doing this, because the most important thing we can do at the moment is buy tickets to support these guys. And we've been able to develop quite a loyal bunch of people who are supporting lots of things and having fun. You know, they're buying something of value to them.
Of course, yeah.
But they're not just... But they also get to feel good about doing it, because at this particular moment, it's very important.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, there is a strong element of community. And hopefully that, you know, with this pandemic, you know, things like that, you know, it's important, as you said earlier, that, you know, in this divisive time, you know, that we can try and bring people together, isn't it? I think it's more important than ever. So something like this is, you know, it's going to help, isn't it?
And I think... to the extent that I have a platform to say anything about it, like I was very straightforward at the beginning that I don't have much of a background or an incredibly sophisticated interest in doing this. So I say that to be clear that you don't have to be sort of a West End Wendy to be wanting to do that. That sounds a bit prejudiced, but one of the guys from one of the national theatre companies was joking about my dad and I were like, oh God, what are we doing? And they were like, oh, we'll make West End Wendy's out of you by the end of next year. But the point is that back to farmers having a feeling of responsibility within their community. There's plenty of space and opportunity for other farmers to do this, and it has been a big success. It's there's a few issues about risk assessment, toilets, and insurance. Mm-hmm. That if you aren't already welcoming public onto your farm, you'll have to be a bit across. But many farms have already diversified to sort of play barns, or so they have a lot of the infrastructure in place, and they just won't necessarily be working this way. And say they welcome weddings and can't at the moment, and I just want to say that it's quite important. And so it's quite important that people just, if they're interested in doing this, think very hard about doing it, because the difference they can make is very significant to the community they live in. And that, I was working up to saying this when we introduced two gentlemen in Verona, there were people who come to that because they thought it was safe and they really wanted to do it. They wanted to share some experience with other human beings, and they, as I said, hadn't left their homes since March, and they were crying because it was quite an emotional thing for them to be able to access. So I mentioned the hashtag before, on farm culture. What I was hoping other farmers would do, and I know this is happening in Staffordshire and Oxfordshire and Essex now, farmers are doing they sort of use that hashtag and then signal that they're open to this kind of approach, and then the people who want to put things on can use that hashtag. And if they're trying to do, I don't know, Northamptonshire, and a farmer says he's open to doing it in Northamptonshire, they can find each other, because you can't have like a central organization. There isn't money for that, but it can sort of come from the grassroots up. And I know the National Youth Theatre are coming back here in the spring of next year with Animal Farm, and I think their intention is just to tour that two farms.
That's really cool. Fantastic.
It'd be really fun.
Yeah.
But we need more farmers to do it, so that they've got a proper touring programme. And that's really like a democratic thing to do with art, because I think a lot of times people think it's for people who aren't me, like, even within my own family, some people, I don't think Shakespeare's very good. I'm not really sure you're allowed to say that. And that's certainly, if you're going to say that, you probably have to study it very hard. Like, you don't get it. And actually, the one of the performances of Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a play I didn't really know very well, it was laugh out loud funny on the last night, because the actors got really into it and started like ad-libbing and just messing about, really, and not making them sound unprofessional. It was really high quality stuff they were doing, but the audience were just rolling around laughing at it. It's not, and it's not, that's a pretty, I don't want this to sound bad, pretty ordinary bunch of people. It wasn't kind of a lot of people who are used to going to Glyndebourne all the time, whatever.
No, I think that's, I guess that's the thing with theatre, isn't it? It doesn't have to be really highbrow. I mean, we as you said, we came to watch Horrible Histories with the kids. You know, two guys sort of dressed up and making children laugh. Henry the VIII, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just about. I mean, it's something for everyone, isn't there? With open air theatre, I guess.
There is, and we've been so far very, very lucky, and the weather has been, when you were here, it was a beautiful day. Like, people were getting slightly sunburned.
It was.
We have so far, just our timetabling and the weather seem to have kind of done a sine wave where it rains when we've got a weekend off. At some point, we're going to get caught out by it, but you just have to suck that up, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean, we're used to that in this country anyway, aren't we? Even many of the summer events, you know, Glastonbury or Wimbledon or whatever it may be. I mean, very often they're washouts, aren't they? But people just get on with it, don't they?
Particularly at the moment. I mean, we're not really we're not completely mad. We're not going to timetable anything outside in January or February or the early part of March. But the way March has been going for the last few years, it's probably scorching hot. But looking at things now, because of this article going in the Times today, I think I had to signal what was going on for next year. And we've got Horrible Histories back, Twelfth Night, As You Like It, The Tempest. This sounds like it's a lot of work, but actually, if the people who are coming run the box office and you just provide the slice of time for them to work, back to just trying to encourage other farmers to think about whether they can do this. It would be kind of amazing if we're going through this really wretched time. You know, many people have sadly died. We've all gone through the sacrifices of the lockdown and everything. But if one thing that people could do is look back on this time and say, people did actually have this amazing flowering of quite democratic culture that was everywhere. and it's not just like the South Bank and Drury Lane. It was happening on the Welsh border and, Essex fields and things. That would feel like it's... you could kind of see a situation where our culture shifted a tiny bit and we appreciated that more and wanted to support it because we kind of got a bit exhausted of watching catch-up TV. And
yes, definitely. Where can farmers or people find out more about this? I think you've just started a newsletter, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. For the plays that are going on here, we have a useful social media platforms for Salton Hall, so Twitter and Facebook and things have a few thousand followers on each of those accounts, which has helped us get started. And we've also been helped by the articles on the BBC News and in national press for that. So in terms of our program, then social media or sign up to a newsletter is the best thing. In terms of other farmers who are doing it, as things stand, the best thing is just to use that hashtag on Twitter, because I haven't got time to run a national. I haven't got the resources to do that, and I don't really see why I should do that. If it's something that people are really behind, then we must have like Arts Council funding or something to let that happen. It would be great if the government did wise up and let that happen and take a bit of leadership on it, because the difference has been huge. It's been great for us to be able to greet these people. We've really enjoyed having these things on the farm, feeling back part of the community, because it was very low. Those of us who were lucky to do a lockdown on a farm still had just this sort of, I'm aware I was a key worker, so I was allowed to go out. I had to go out and farm. But people who've had to, I don't know how people who were sort of locked in a one-bedroom flat on the top floor of a building in Tooting, I personally really struggle with that. Mm-hmm. But all of us have been missing being part of a community, I think.
We have.
And so we felt part of a community, and it was a really blessed thing for us, just an honour to be able to do it. And chances are we're facing this until May, June at least next year in some form or other. So I did just want to encourage people to see whether they can do something in their community for the same thing. And it doesn't have to be the National Youth Theatre doing specially written work. One of the reasons why I thought we would do this, I went down the high street in Wem, and the kids, like the youth drama group in Wem, which is quite active, had been rehearsing for ages to do Joseph, which I hadn't really paid any attention to. I don't want to sound bad about that. I didn't know anybody involved or whatever. And I walked down the high street after I finished showing the spring. I decided to walk to Wales, which sounds grand, but I've explained to anybody. And I walked back through the town high street. It's a pretty, a really wonderful community in that town that supports everybody. And I walked down the high street, and there were lots of handwritten notes on the shop windows saying, "We've got to close. Everybody stay safe. Look after yourselves. We want to see you healthy and well when we get back. And we're going to really need your support when we get back on hairdressers and, electronic short stores and ironmongers and things." And then you got to where they advertise the shows for the town hall. And we have actually quite a good program. They get stuff off the South Bank oftentimes for the sort of subsidized rural stuff. And then the kids' version of Joseph with these, which are big posters that, you know, somebody spent some money on making happen. And then there's these things saying cancelled over the top of them. And just everything said cancelled. And it felt really wretched. And then you thought for a second what that might be like if you were like 11 years old and you spent ages learning your lines.
Yeah.
And there's no reason, you know, we've got spare Dutch barns and things on farms. And if we think imaginatively, these things can be put on. And they should be, really, because they are quite nurturing and really important whilst things are difficult for us all to have something to look forward to.
I think you made a really good point about people who've perhaps already diversified and perhaps, you know, thinking specifically wedding venues. You know, as you say, you know, you can't have weddings there at the moment, so, and you're already geared up to have a number of people on the place. You know, it's not a massive change, is it, really?
It's not a massive change. It's people shouldn't be naive and think that it's a wildly commercial thing to be up to doing. Like, I think you can probably within our thing, we definitely can justify holding on to people who otherwise we'd have to scratch our head about their future. And another thing that's come out of this, I'm going to put an art exhibition on, because this farm will be a bit unusual in this respect. We have about 12 artists who different mediums who do work on the farm. And my dad and I have always been quite gentle about people like doing that. But there's some really impressive work. And so we've got a barn that can help handle the public, and we're putting that exhibition on, because in the case of artists, some of them make quite a bit of their money out of exhibiting at car fairs and things, all of which are not happening, and, you know, might sell a calendar of their photographs or something. So providing an environment where they can get attention. So that will be going on in November, because I'm expecting not really to be able to go anywhere or do anything. So I might as well try and do my work and have an open house in that barn if people want to look at art. And it's an impressive range of stuff. You know, that Andrew Fusick-Peters is exhibiting. He often has his photographs on the front of the Times and national newspapers. Graham Taylor, who is a really respected ceramicist, he's made some pots out of the clay that the barrow is made from. He's exhibiting, and then some carved stonework, and yeah, that's all in flight at the moment. But I don't. If everything has to get more local again, then quite important that we, and it's also quite nice to put something special on that will only last a couple of weeks that people can look forward to, and I think that sort of thing is pretty. To be honest with you, I'd like to guard the flame anyway. And even if no one's allowed to come, we're still going to put the exhibition on like a raging against the dying of the light. And we'll just leave it there and we'll put it on when it's safe later. But I suspect we're looking at a world where, for goodness sake, it's a barn. It's basically one side of windows. It's basically outside. And my choices are, because the farm should be by November, tidy and ready to go into next year and not demanding that much of us, and it's normally a slightly quiet time when we get to tinker about on stuff, and that's what I'd like to do with that time. But massively appreciated, I think, by the people who get to exhibit their work
for sure.
And I really warmly want to encourage other farmers to think about doing this, because we have the privilege of space that not everybody else has got.
Definitely. Well, we will be back as long as if Wales ever comes out of local lockdown and we can cross the border again, we will come watch some more plays. But let's begin to wrap this up with the hard hitting questions, because I'm sure you've got work to do. I know you've struggled with this question, but what is your all time favourite song?
I think it's Teenage Kicks. Has that been said before?
Oh, man, that's such a good joke. It hasn't been said before. John Peel's favourite song, famously.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I think it's hard to improve on that one song.
Yeah.
And like John Peel said it, so
I would
defer to him.
totally agree. Brilliant choice. I've got to ask this. If you had access to a time machine and could come back to Salton Hall for a day at any point in its history, when would you choose?
No, I'm not allowed two answers, but I'll tell you the conflict in my head. In the Civil War, 5,500 troops marched past this house going to try and take Wem. Royalist troops, and the whole thing was like a Monty Python fiasco, and there was like 40 people guarding Wem for the parliamentarians, but they prevailed against 5,500 troops.
Okay.
So I think that sounds like, I mean, it's bloody and awful, but also a fiasco. So I think I'd quite like to see what exactly happened there, because they weren't ready. They were like throwing the defences up and everything, and they put women in their petticoats on top of the church to pretend to be soldiers. And
wow.
So that I think that will be the highlight for this area. And we've got one spur from the Civil War and this sort of collection of random things that have been found over the years. So I'd like to see that. But also, if I could use a time machine once more safely, I would like to see go back to the 1130s and just understand exactly what this thing we've been excavating was. Yeah. But I think probably the Civil War, if you may insist on one choice.
Yeah, fantastic. There's a lot of Civil War history around here, actually. They burned the two villages, and Wrexham was a staunchly royalist town. Charles I stayed there a couple of times. Anyway.
Yeah, we could get into that. But yeah, the Civil War in North Shropshire, I think someone's just written on it. I haven't got the book. I'll probably read it this winter. But it wasn't straightforward. And there was quite funny things. Very quickly, Prince Rupert went past Wem. And said, "Oh, it's crow's nest of a place. Don't want to bother with that place, and we won't take it." And then it ended up being the base from which the parliamentarians then took Shrewsbury and all these other things. It was a massive strategic mistake to leave this kind of inoculation of parliamentary forces in this part of the country. Mm. Anyway. You've got one or two more very serious questions, I think.
I do. It is my dream to have a history podcast one day, so I'll get you one for that. you studied law at University, as we've talked about. If you were in charge of the country, what's the first law you'd bring in?
So I'm really glad that you gave me the chance to see these questions ahead of time. And I thought about this quite hard, and I'm not sure I would change a single law. The one thing I would want us to do is just honour parliamentary democracy and do things properly, because we have been quite we've been short-circuiting our systems a lot lately, and that means that voices that need to be heard aren't heard, and it's driving the divisions and things. And we have to remember that there's a lot more stuff that we agree on than we want to not agree on, and back to the Civil War, weirdly, we've got 400 years of quiet evolution of our constitution, and we need to honor the systems that people put in place before, because they knew what they were doing. And it feels the same sometimes on a farm. You might rip a hedge out, we haven't done that for a long time, not in my lifetime, and we haven't done much of that on this farm, but the old places where it has been done get to a year like this and you're like, I know why they did that. And these two bits of ground, the wisdom is an effort to put these systems in place, be it a hedge, be it a parliamentary democracy. And when you sort of get, you think you've got this flash of wisdom, then you should be very careful about disturbing what generations of people have put up and then not disturbed for a long time. So I wouldn't change any one statute. And I think also statutes are quite blunt instruments, they're the last resort, aren't they? Culture is far more important than we see that with the local lockdown things, and everyone's vastly confused. In a lot of ways, there's too many rules, and we would be better with just a slightly better sense of direction.
No, I agree. Okay. What's your favourite quote?
Oh, you've told me this in advance, and I've completely forgotten to prepare it. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm not massively religious, but I think there's some people have issues about what St. Paul writes, but I think St. Paul to the Romans, I'll go there for guidance quite often, I think. Okay. I'll say that.
that's really interesting. Okay. And lastly then, I was asked this question to finish, but what's your favourite agriculture related social media account to follow?
I really appreciate my friend Sam Dean, who helped me with converting to, we were studying at Harper together. So his family farm down in County Cork, and he's at Arable Sam.
Okay. Why do you like following him? Is he informative, funny?
I think we went on a similar journey at the same time, and yeah, he's informative and humorous as well, in only the way that only the Irish can be.
Okay. Tim, fantastic. I'm glad we finally got the chance to do this.
Yeah, I'm sorry I was such a shambles getting on the radio, on the recording for you, but it's just...
Not at all. I think
time was pressure for everybody, I think. I would not want to be sitting down having recorded the podcast, but having Fields of Clay undrilled. That would be
absolutely
really
not. And I think we can all tell after this interview that you have got quite a lot going on. You're a busy man. So keep up the good work. I'm full of admiration for everything you're doing there. And as I said, we will be back across. I'll sign up to the newsletter so we don't miss any any place, and we'll be back across.
Excuse any spelling mistakes. I'll explain.
I will. All right. Cheers, Tim. Thanks again.
Good man. Take care.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.